The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined, of course, by the iron-fisted overlord of Danwei.com, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. How are you, man?
I'm doing very, very well. What a beautiful day it is.
Oh, my God. Beijing this today. Easily the best day I can remember. I think the AQI was like 47 when I left the office
and
today.
And the first day of school, I think, for Chinese school, wasn't it?
Actually, it's back to school on Friday for my kids, at least. But since it is back to school week, our summer has come to an end. And we're back to serious discussions about more serious issues. And as luck would have it, just as we are turning our attention back to the news and getting back to our regularly scheduled program, China's trial of the century wrapped. And of course, that was the trial of Bo Xilai, the former mayor of Chongqing, who was brought up on charges of bribery, corruption, and abuse of power. That ended on Monday after a surprisingly long 5 days in the city of Jinan, Shandong. The trial was something of a denouement to events that were set in motion, of course, in early 2012 in February, when Bo's erstwhile right-hand man, Chongqing's top cop Wang Lijun, was removed from office and days later attempted to defect to the American consulate in Chengdu. So in the months that followed, we saw Bo Xilai's wife, Gu Kailai, implicated in and later found guilty of the murder of Briton Neil Haywood. Bo himself was stripped of his positions and of his party membership and has been in prison since April of last year. Is that correct? I think that's...
Under house arrest starting March 2012.
Right. Yeah. The trial itself has, of course, raised many intriguing questions. State media tended to emphasize the supposed openness and fairness of the transparency of it, anyway. And they noted that they had allowed over 100 spectators into the courtroom. There were a dozen journalists in attendance. And they even put up a partial... though still kind of, you know, enthralling transcript of the proceedings, 140 characters at a time on Sina Weibo. Jeremy Page of the Wall Street Journal called this China's first show trial of the social media age. So was this real transparency? Was this just the latest manifestation of what we on Seneca like to call adaptive authoritarianism? And what did it all mean? So here to help us make sense of the trial are two seasoned reporters who have followed not only the trial but the dramatic events leading up to it very, very closely. We're delighted to welcome for his long overdue first appearance on Seneca, James Miles of The Economist, a long-serving and well-respected member of the community of foreign correspondents here in Beijing. Welcome to Seneca, James.
Very glad to be here, Kaiser.
It's great to have you. So we are also delighted equally to be joined in the studio once again by Ed Wong, reporter for the New York Times and something of a regular on the show. Glad you could join us here, Ed. How are you, man?
Thanks a lot, Kaiser.
So let's jump right in. I don't think we have other business to dispense with, and let's talk about this amazing trial. First of all, to each of you, both of you were in Jinan. What, if there's one thing each of you could name, let's start with you, Ed. What was genuinely surprising to you about the trial? What was one feature that struck you as unusual or without precedent in the annals of Chinese jurisprudence?
Well, you know that any China watcher doesn't like to use the words without precedent, but I guess the length of the trial, I think, surprised everyone. Most sure. People thought it would be a short trial, maybe 1 to 2 days, and that there could possibly very well be a guilty pleas by Bo, and then it would be wrapped up. But I think the length and as well as the detail in the transcripts that were released, there were obviously certain sensitive things that were redacted from the transcripts, but people who have talked to people who were in the courtroom said most of the material that was said in court is in the transcripts.
Wow, that's impressive. And James, what about you? Was there anything that particularly stuck out as...
The fact that transcripts were released at all, that this was highly unusual in Chinese court history, at least in the history of communist China, the handling of high-level sensitive cases such as this. We've not had what appeared to be at least near verbatim transcripts released before. There had been rumors just before the trial began that that it might actually be broadcast live. This was a rumor that was put about by Hong Kong media.
That it was going to be broadcast to a room in the hotel where there were going to be...
To a room in the hotel. And by the time the trial began, we had lost hope of that. Officials, indeed, were saying that it wouldn't be so. But when it came to the opening of the trial, we were sat in this press room with two large screens at the front. And it wasn't a live feed, but what did pop up were these... was the Weibo feed of the courthouse, the Intermediate People's Court in Jinan, with screeds of stuff. And we weren't expecting that. What we've had before in such cases are simply general summaries issued by Xinhua, which are predominantly the case of the prosecution. And now, for the first time since the trial of the Gang of Four in 1980-81, we were seeing the defense's side, and cogently and carefully put and feistily put, most fascinating of all by
feisty. Feisty is the word that many people have been using. Jeremy, were you? Was there anything that surprised you in particular about the proceedings?
It did go on for longer. I mean, yeah, I think my sense was that it would be like his wife's trial, like Ukhailai's trial.
Right, that it would be really succinct and really pro forma. Right?
You know, but that said, this government is getting very good at kind of hoodwinking the masses.
Do you think that's what this was? It was a hoodwink of the masses?
Well, you know, I mean, perhaps I should be quiet because as eminent a scholar of Chinese law as Professor Jerome Cohen has said that the fact that they allowed Bo Xilai to really give himself a proper defense in the public domain, you know, on the internet and in the media, was a real advance.
Jeremy's fighting every instinct here. He's just fighting. You can see him squirming right now.
Personally,
he wants to say it. Just.
Well, I mean, what a fucking wank.
Okay.
Really, you know, it wasn't transparent. We don't know who made the decision. We don't know how the decision was made. You know, we don't... some of the things to me that the terrifying things about Bo Xilai, the fact that, in the words of Wang Boming, the publisher of Caijing magazine, who, even without Hu Shuli, continues to be a leading liberal voice in China, he said what Bo Xilai did in Chongqing was lock up the 20 richest men and confiscate their assets. This has not been addressed.
Let's get to that. Let's get to that in a little bit.
It's just, you know, okay, well, whatever, there was a Weibo feed and blah, blah, blah. What was the crime? Who made the decision? How, you know, what is it? There's no pro... It's not... rule of law. It's still a theater.
I don't think anybody is arguing seriously that this was evidence for, you know, a significant stride toward rule of law. But I think...
Maybe not, I wasn't there. Can James, please?
I think in many ways it was theatrical and clearly very much rehearsed. And we saw in terms of the visuals of the trial, I mean, such as they were, very few photographs and hardly any footage released, but such as
and
we saw.
And the only two seven-foot policemen
sort of
in China.
Right. Player-sized policemen on either side just to make him look tiny. There was clearly a very large staged element. But what we have to assume, I think, is that the Chinese leadership wanted to utterly blacken the name of this man, and they wanted the Chinese people to agree with their point of view on this. They wanted to eliminate him entirely, his influence from the political scene, and in that they failed.
Utterly.
They took a risk, and they failed to pull it off, and I think that was fascinating.
Right, that's to me the most interesting thing. I mean, when the trial opened, anyone who would pipe up with some comment to the effect of, you know, we're seeing increased transparency, this may be a move toward, you know, dare we speak its name, rule of law, was just shouted down by a lot of
people
the observers.
Like me.
By people like you, exactly.
Right. Sorry.
Well, no, I mean, I think that what's interesting here is that, you know, I think a lot of the better-known folks were you know, eager to dismiss out of hand, but I think we saw a lot of people turn around on this question pretty quickly. I mean, it was patently far-fetched to suggest that the entire thing was scripted and that it stayed within the scripted parameters, right?
But, Kaiser, I don't think that at least I didn't read anyone saying that people were reading from a script and...
I don't mean literally script. Nobody means right. literally script.
I know. So, but I actually think I would argue that there were parameters set and the trial did stay within those parameters. Because I think if you look at the testimony from everyone and everything that was presented in the trial, the parameters were clear. Like, I mean, from reading texture analysis, you can say the parameters were like, Ball cannot talk about internal politics in the party. He can't talk about the party elite. He can't talk about policies. He can't defend himself openly. Like, he can't make address the people of Chongqing or Dalian or the people of China.
That's a good point.
Everything was narrowly confined to his personal life and to these very specific instances of bribes. There were probably many more instances in which he could be implicated on bribery. Implicated, perhaps not proven, but none of that was raised. And they were very selective in what they chose. And they might, I think they knew that Bo's, his speaking style, the oratory that he would deliver, it was all calculated. And I mean, it was all, they knew, they took that into account when they sort of allowed him the stage. Because,
well, why did they give him even as much room as he was able to have? I mean, I agree
with James's assessment too, that perhaps the effect that they hoped the trial would have didn't come, like it didn't, the trial didn't come off the way they hoped it would, perhaps. But they allowed this because I think that there's too much conflict. There's too much, many unanswered questions over how Bo was detained and over why he was detained. And there's too many
popular
supporters. Right,
he's
too popular.
He's too well connected.
Right.
And everybody in the establishment has some kind of connection.
And he also has powerful allies, right? He's got, his family has powerful allies. You can't just, it's not like some low-level official, you can just have a one-day trial and then like not release any information and get it over with. I think they needed to have Bo, like they figured Bo's performance would actually play to the sense of legitimacy of the trial. And also they thought that the evidence they presented would undermine his reputation, which it might not. Like I was talking to a friend in Chongqing today, and he said Chongqing people are still widely supportive of Bo. So I agree with James that perhaps the effect that they hoped the trial would have failed, like it didn't have it to the degree that they would have hoped.
And a big question that we're now asking as we speculate about the verdict is to what extent Bo Xilai's behavior in the court likely to count against him when it comes to deciding how long he spends in prison. Mm-hmm. And you could argue, yes, here was a man who showed no sign of remorse. He rejected every single point laboriously, every single piece of evidence that was produced by the prosecution pretty well. He had a point to make about it. But nonetheless, he did play the game in an extremely important way that Ed has just alluded to. He kept the, generally speaking, well, we know that there are one or two bits, important bits perhaps, that were redacted. But generally speaking, the script kept within this bubble, this rather sort of salacious bubble of that we all like to gaze at, because it's rather like gazing at the private lives of a royal family, say in the West, without any sense of how his private life or his business dealings connect with the wider world of Chinese politics.
Right.
And they must be enormously grateful.
And this is a tacit agreement that goes beyond this particular trial. This is sort of, some of the basic unwritten rules of Chinese political cultures laid out by MIT's Lucian Pai years ago. I mean, he talked about how you just can't show cracks in the facade of unanimity. There are rules in remonstration, even against the emperor, that date back to time immemorial. You can go after personal moral turpitude. You can go after things like that. But you can't go after specific policy. You can't go after you can't expose the existence of factions and things.
And that was very much the ground rule situation in the build up to the trial of the Gang of Four. That too was presented by the party as a great advance for the rule of law after the mayhem, the lawlessness of the Cultural Revolution. They very carefully coached all the, I mean, there were hundreds of people who were able to go into the courtroom to watch that, but explained to them and to the lawyers taking part that this was not about the party line. This was not about Jiang Qing's relationship with Mao Zedong. It's interesting looking back on that trial that she was able to communicate one very important point with that wonderful pithy quote at the end of it.
I was
Chairman Mao's dog, and whoever he told me to bite, I bit. We had nothing like that from Bo Xilai, and they must have been afraid of it.
Right. Well, I'm going to read a couple of things that people did say in the press and see what you guys think. John Garneau wrote a piece that I thought was a little bit surprising. He talked to Li Zhuang, as a couple of people did. Li Zhuang, by the way, gave a really interesting interview in NetEase. It was only in Chinese. I haven't seen it translated into English yet, but I read it, and it's fascinating. But John wrote in The Age, he said that there are a dozen reasons why Bo's trial doesn't meet true justice, or doesn't meet our definition of true justice, is measured in the West. The decision to prosecute was entirely political. Bo couldn't appoint his own lawyer. The published transcripts were incomplete, as the New York Times reports today. But the outcome that has been pressured by civil society and negotiated within the elite has lifted the bar for what is possible and further raised the legitimacy costs of the litany of judicial abuses that will continue to take place each day in China. Do you think he's correct in that? Has this sort of shifted the goalposts, or changed or raised the bar?
I think it's hard to tell unless, I mean, I think you have to wait and then you have to survey people to see how many people watch the trial, like what their impressions were of what a trial should look like. I think there's the potential that it might have taught some people who observed it closely that there's a certain procedures you're supposed to follow in a trial, including things like cross-examinations, Jerry Cohen pointed out in his essay.
Which was absent, right?
Ball got to cross-examine witnesses for the prosecution. It was there, cross-examination.
Yeah, that was what Jerry Cohen's point was.
Yeah, right.
My point is that, like, I think it's hard to tell immediately, like, whether what the takeaway is for Chinese citizens in terms of, like, what they're supposed to learn about how a trial proceeds. But you'd have to do some sort of survey research into seeing, like, whether it impacts their idea of what a trial is.
The problem is, like, if you're Bo Xilai, okay, you get treated kind of nice, you know?
Right.
And everybody, to a certain extent, is probably aware that if you're not Bo Xilai, you don't get treated so nice, you know?
Right.
I don't see how you can read into that progress. I mean, John Garneau is somebody who spent a lot of time, who knows Bo Xilai and his milieu much better than I do. And Professor Jerry Cohen is an expert, is the world's leading expert on Chinese law, I guess, Western expert, I would say, or one of them. And both of them are saying that there is some kind of progress that this trial represents. I don't see it myself. I just think it's a...
What about what Li Zhuang said? I mean, I take actually what he has to say about things maybe a little more seriously than what Jeremy Goldcorn has to say about that. You know, Li, for whoever isn't familiar with him, was one of the lawyers who defended people who had come under the hammer in the crackdown on the Strike Black campaign.
And then himself had a confession, tortured out of him.
Sure.
And then this all came out and he was let go.
And yet his take on this was that this was meaningful progress, right?
Yeah, I don't know, you know.
Well, it's only meaningful until we see what happens after this. Bo Xilai was special. He was a member of the Politburo, and that accords special privileges when it comes to handling his case in court. We know for a fact, I think we can say, that he won't be executed. They never execute Politburo members. They never execute their spouses. The Weibo feed, I think... would probably be linked in people's minds with the specialness of Bo Xilai. And whether if we get another vice chairman of the MPC or a government minister who goes down for prosecution, whether we get the same degree of openness, I think it's very much open to question. And I'm not sure many people would expect it.
Yeah, I think that probably the smartest response that I've seen on this is, you know, who in their right mind would try to draw conclusions from this, the most... exceptional, unusual, mm-hmm. outlier of a
right.
case.
It's like, that makes sense to me.
That
going back to the
Ganga,
for example, that James is pointing out. I mean, it was broadcast live on TV. And what trials? How many trials have been broadcast live on TV since?
The Ganga 4 trial was I think not broadcast live. It was excerpts of it were broadcast mm-hmm. on evening television, big chunks, and in the same way that these Weibo transcripts were released. I mean, it's very interesting the parallels between then and now. And interesting that I think it's become sort of part of the story that the Gang of Four trial was broadcast live. What they did was they broadcast big chunks of it that kind of looked like it was
right.
happening.
And they weren't live.
That was unprecedented. But when it came to sensitive bits of those broadcasts, you would get an announcer kind of voicing over what the defendant was saying. We also know that in the background, these defendants have been the defendants as well as crucially the witnesses have been coached over and over again in how to say things, to the extent that when the pictures of the trial when the trial was filmed for television, they would actually take scenes over again until they got it right, and it then became sort of part of a story that that the Gang of Four trial was unprecedentedly open, and we saw right. all this kind of raw testimony going on, and I think one effect of these Weibo transmissions, we might sort of come away with the same sort of feeling that
sure.
actually we did get the whole story. It was wonderfully open. In fact, interesting little bits, and the New York Times has done some fantastic reporting on this. Little bits were missed out, and we still don't really know what other little bits might be in there.
Let's talk about that. What were some of the little bits that we're aware of? Things that you know, momentarily saw the light of day and then were redacted. I'm sure somebody compiled.
Well, there was only one bit that momentarily saw the light of day and it was redacted. I mean, we know that from reporting and talking to sources, there were stuff that never saw the light of day, and that includes threats that were made against Ball by investigators and sort of how they tried to coerce him into making confessions or playing along with the trial. Like just a few weeks before the trial, he was told, well, you've got, you know, the party has complete control over your fate, and you could either end up like this one guy, this vice governor of Anhui, who was executed in 2004, or right. you could end up like Liu Jiajun, the former railway minister, who is still alive. He was given a suspended death sentence, and that's because he played along. He helped out the court during his trial. So, I mean, things like that, if they were revealed in a court, you know, in the West, you would sort of, you would question the justice system. But it was not, it was redacted. He said that in court, and it was redacted. It was never allowed in the transcripts. And then James can probably talk about the six-point guide. Did you examine the six-point guidance that was?
Okay. I don't know.
right. So one of the things that saw the point of that saw the light of day, as you say, was there were several versions of the prosecution's final argument that were posted
right.
with the Weibo feed. And in the first version, there was a paragraph mentioning where the prosecution's trying to rebut an argument that Ball had made earlier in the trial. And this argument that Ball made had never appeared in the transcripts. And the prosecution says, well, earlier you're saying that you issued this fake medical certificate to show Wang Lijun was crazy because you were following the six-point guidance that your superiors had given you. And then the prosecution then goes on and say, well, what we're saying is that you issued that certificate before the six-point guidance was issued. And in any case, that order to issue certificate was never part of the guidance. So they're acknowledging that there's this existence of this thing called a six-point guidance that was issued from Beijing.
And then that was redacted.
Then that version of transcript was pulled off a few minutes later. And then eventually, like half an hour later, they put the transcript back up, but that paragraph was missing.
Ah, interesting.
But I think the point is that nothing in the trial is supposed to touch on Beijing or Party Central. And that argument by Bois and then the rebuttal from the prosecution touched on the fact that Party Central wanted to cover up the Wang Lijun incident.
So, I mean, you know, for me, at the end of it, it comes down to what Bo Guagua wrote in his letter to your newspaper, Ed. He wrote this tiny little open letter, right?
Right.
And he talks about the clandestine detainment of his parents and how he has had no contact with them. And this is what it comes down to. We don't know. They've been in a black box. It's clandestine. The party continues to behave like a criminal organization when it comes to the so-called justice system. So, you know, whatever you say, stuff was released. We saw photos. You know, we don't know. We saw video of Gu Kailai that was edited. And I mean, as the Twitter feed of Relevant Organs joked about her being hopped up on goofballs, she may very well have been she looked right. like she was high on ecstasy to me. And maybe she's just crazy. But we don't know. Did they just, like, fry her brain with MDMA and then say, like, confess? Maybe. Quite possibly.
And crucially, she wasn't brought into courts and nobody could ask those questions. Right. I mean, not that they would have been allowed to, or sort of given the frame of reference for the questioning, it may have been difficult to go into some of those areas. But it is very interesting when we talk about the rule of law and the ability to cross-examine witnesses that one of the most crucial ones was not there. And the judge said that she had refused to to come. But nonetheless, you would have thought that a woman under threat of execution
would want
to be convinced.
James, I want to go back very quickly to our discussion about the Gang of Four trial. There was a sense at that time for everyone who was in China that this was closure. This was the end of an epoch. They were trying to close the book, final chapter of a very, very dark time in China's history. It isn't a comparable moment here right now. I would argue that there isn't a sense that this is there's finality to this, that this ends a period of time. There isn't a sense of the historical poignancy of this moment here, and I don't think that all comparisons to the stage managing of the Gang of Four trial is apt. What do you?
Well, I think it depends what you're trying to bring closure on. I think there are two very important aspects of the Bo Xilai case. One is that he was a singer of red songs who was loved by leftists. They saw him as a charismatic, good-looking, strong man in the vein of Vladimir Putin. And indeed, they often made comparisons between the two men. To the extent that they have not knocked the left on the head, yes, the trial has failed to achieve closure. Those leftists are out there. They've been cheering their man on throughout the trial. There were a handful of them outside the court displaying their Mao portraits. And one of them I saw with a ceramic a bust of Chairman Mao. But the other big aspect of this, which I think, this message probably has come across much more effectively, namely that he was somebody who kind of broke away from party center. He was doing his own thing down there in Chongqing. He was actually being a politician, perhaps the first real politician that China has had since Chairman Mao. He was trying to tap into public sentiment, to work out what it is that the public wanted, and bizarrely, red songs seemed to appeal at least to a significant section of the population there. And they were resentful of that popularity and saw him as a threat, and as a threat particularly coming up to a time of political transition when new and untested leaders would be at the top in Beijing.
If that was truly his crime, if theatricality was the big threat, why give him a stage for more theatrics?
Go on.
Well, I would say that they hoped that public sentiment being so disposed to believing that every official is profoundly corrupt, that it would take only shards of evidence that the Bo was corrupt and everyone would sign up to that.
Right.
But the very odd thing about Bo is that it doesn't stick. And we haven't seen this happen before in anti-corruption cases in China. This is extremely unusual, and I'm not sure that they would have fully read I'm not sure they fully assessed the dangers that he would come off in this kind of Teflon manner. But if I were a provincial official looking at what's happened to Bo Xilai, his disappearance for 17 months into this black hole that Jeremy very accurately described, regardless of his performance in court, I would be thinking, that's a very risky way of caring about politics. A Bo is going down, and he's going down for a very, very long time. It will be very unlikely that he is able to make a comeback.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And back to James's point about sort of the fact that they probably assumed just rolling out a few bits of evidence about his corruption would bury him, at least in the public eye. I think part of the irony, at least when I spoke with my friend in Chongqing today, he said that he had heard some sentiment saying, oh, yeah, they only could get him on 20 million renminbi. And what's that? Like, 20 million is
what's
nothing
that?
Compared
right.
to most officials. Right. And I remember one of the first comments on the public comments in the Weibo court official Weibo blog was the same thing. Someone had posted, oh, it's only 20 million renminbi. And then that was later deleted later that evening. But part of the irony, I think, is the fact that people are so inured to corruption now that amount, I think they might have misjudged the amount of evidence they needed to to really tar him in the public eye.
Dr. Evil's demand for $1 million, right?
There's another little thing that's been going on in the last week that is maybe a little relevant is the detention on charges of soliciting prostitutes of Charles Xue Manzi, one of the biggest celebrities on Weibo, who's a Chinese-born, I think, with an American passport businessman, who's a liberal voice and one of the big V's that has sort of come under scrutiny from various conservatives.
Do you see this as more relevant? Do you think that going after the CNPC officials?
My point was that they've done a sting on him for hiring prostitutes. And the reaction, at least on the Chinese internet, is, oh, he hired a prostitute?
What? What's that? Yeah.
A similar thing has happened with Bo, oh, 20 million, only 20 million. One house in Cannes, one house.
Jeremy, one of the things that you talked about, and I want to bring this up now, is that there are so many parts of Bo's controversial legacy that were just only flicked at or not even addressed at all during the trial, including much of the shenanigans that he engaged in cracking down on organized crime in Chongqing.
The Strike Black campaign, because it was not addressed at all. And Ed, it was a completely
or the Black Strike, as the liberals like to criticize it. Right?
Ed James, what was going on there? Why was the scope of his criminality limited to just mainly things from his years in Dalian?
Well, we know in the case of the Strike Black campaign that involved the rounding up of thousands of people in Chongqing, the mobilization of the whole police force and government apparatus there, targeting people with suspected organized crime links without with hardly any regard for any kind of due legal process. People are thrown away into cells, tortured,
executed,
no access to lawyers. And once you start raising this in a public forum, you have to ask yourself, well, how come a provincial level entity, for such it is, and Wang Lijun, the police chief, is not just a police chief. He has the rank of a deputy governor. And was able to carry out such wanton and widespread abuses of power.
This is an indictment of the system, and
exactly.
Not just of an individual.
So you've just got to narrow it down to a villa in France and £500,000 pounds kind of stuffed in one's pocket from a secret government project in Dalian many years ago. That's all that's safe for the Communist Party, I think.
And Lady Macbeth's wife.
Right. And the love triangle. Yeah. But I think, James, you also had a good point in one of your one of the essays that ran on your blog before the trial, which is the idea of the sort of neo-socialist ideology and how important that is to the party. So I think one of the reasons why they left Chongqing untouched was because Chongqing and what became known as the Chongqing model is this sort of new brand of socialism where you build low-cost housing, you take out corruption, you sing red, you sort of espouse sort of Mao's ideas to a certain degree. And you see sort of Xi Jinping and his cohorts adopting some of that rhetoric. Either they consciously or unconsciously said, this is the way, this wins us legitimacy with the public. I think they might have looked at what Bo was doing, seen how popular it made him. And so these days, they're sort of trotting out some of that policy, or at least they're saying they back some of that policy on a nationwide level. And so you can't attack any of the policies in Chongqing because those policies are the ones that are being mainstreamed into the party.
Right. That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, they want to go after the messenger, but not the message necessarily.
And there's an interesting comparison again there with the trial of the Gang of Four, insofar as part of the point of that, even though they tried to kind of, again, narrow those sort of terms of reference of the trial, but part of the point was to thoroughly repudiate the excesses of
the
Maoism and push China forward into a new era, embrace Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms. There was a sort of policy message that was supposed to be extracted from this, even though it was never made explicit. But in this case, even though I think when Bo Xilai was first detained, we thought of this as as being part of a policy struggle, a two-line struggle, if you like.
Right.
You know, between repudiation of the reformists in Beijing and leftists down there. What we've seen, as Ed has just said, is actually something very different now. That is not the message at all from this. It's getting rid of this one man and his populism. But the broader policy of China has indeed shifted quite markedly over the last few months in the direction of Borsilaism.
Interesting.
Right. I think one person said Chinese intelligence said they're walking the road of Borsilai now without Borsilai. He's saying that about China and its leaders.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of talk about possible horse trading that was going on, that some of Min Xinpei in particular wrote a piece in which he suggested that there were compromises made in the interest of placating supporters of Boa, or tacit supporters of Boa in the upper echelons. I think a more accurate read is the one that we're talking about here, where we're people who are actually quite appreciative of the policies that he pursued in Chongqing, but without all the sort of politicking and the theatrics and the cult of personality around it. But what do you think of these horse trading theories?
I think the verdict, and well, we know what the verdict will be, but the sentencing will give us some guidance as to that. I'm inclined to think. I mean, if we're allowed to stick our necks out, I mean, I think there is a possibility that his sentence might be somewhat lighter than. I mean, many of us, I think, would have expected 20 years, if not life. But I think it's possible. I mean, given that it really doesn't make any difference whether it's 16, 17, or 20 years, the standard practice in the case of Politburo members who are put in prison is to keep them locked up for a few years, then release them on medical parole, keep them under heavy guard, under house arrest, and in very pleasant conditions. So the likelihood of him actually spending even 16 years inside is pretty small, I would have thought.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. But I think it's possible that that part of this trading would have been over the length of sentence and his behavior in court, and I think he to some extent fulfilled their wishes on that, and I would bravely hazard a guess that the sentence might actually be somewhat shorter than some predict.
I mean, although he may have fulfilled the technical qualifications of their wishes, I mean, not straying too far, but the stridency of his defense, his very obstinate refusal to own any of the prosecution's allegations, that's not going to. I mean, the prosecution at the very end was harping on this quite a bit. He wasn't at all cooperative. I just don't think that bodes well for a lighter sentencing.
Well, you've given me an opportunity to completely reverse my position a few seconds ago, and yes, I agree that a heavy sentence, 20 years or worse, is still possible.
So now, I mean, one of the things that he really didn't do was he didn't play along with what I think, James, you correctly identify as their overall goal in this, which was to, you know, paint him as unequivocally a villainous character. A Weibo poll that was conducted shortly after the trial said that people who had a negative pretrial impression of Bo had seen their impressions of him improved by a margin of 3-1 over those whose impressions had gone the other way. Is this the knee-jerk anti-authoritarian stance that you find among Weibo users, that cynicism?
By the way, I was looking for it. You're citing the Reuters. Did you find the poll? Because I looked for the poll. I couldn't find it.
You didn't find the poll?
Yeah, I couldn't find it.
It's entirely possible that it had been taken down.
Right.
But let's assume that to be true. And it does seem to me that, you know, people were on Weibo, as I would have expected, were eager to, you know, to come to his defense, to point more toward the ineptitude of the prosecution than...
Well, he's a skillful politician, but also, crucially, a master of propaganda. The journalism was you know, it was his field of study, and he loved to micromanage journalists. He must have done quite an effective job, given the degree of popularity that we detect in Chongqing and in Dalian, and indeed further afield, as you suggest. So I think it's possible that he's very much aware of. I mean, the message he's trying to get across is not just "I'm innocent." It's "I'm still a very plausible man. I don't lose my temper in court. I'm not a Jiang Qing who railed against the witnesses, who had altercations with the judge. He was very deferential in court, Bo Xilai, and he is showing that he's still a statesman. I think that that was very much the message: calm, considered, and perhaps he's thinking China over the next 10 years is not going to be stable. This political environment may well change over the next few years in a way that's advantageous to me.
The feeling I had when reading Bo Guaguai's letter to the New York Times was very much that this is the letter of somebody who sees a future in China after the next big change. It seemed like something that signaled to me a political ambition.
Right, and he's in law school now, as you know.
He's in law school, right. Columbia Law School. Oh right. My gosh!
I mean, I think anyone who's deeply steeped in these families, and even us outside observers, we know that rehabilitation is possible, and that if you bide your time, then things can turn around.
There may be second acts in Chinese politics,
right? And there could be, like, I mean, right? Yeah, and the party is fractured. I mean, control.
In Deng's case, sure.
Control is more fractured. Like. There are more factions, like controlled is more fractured now within the party, probably, I think, than it was, say, 10 years ago. And you don't know, like, one person's allies could change the next day. But going back to what you were saying about the Bo's performance and whether he was sort of playing along, I do think that he still stayed within the parameters. And so I wouldn't say that his stridency was unexpected. I would guess that every official was putting on the show, and I'll call it a show just like Jeremy's calling it a show, expected that. They knew that that was coming, and that they also knew that that would lend it more legitimacy. The fact letting him go off lends it more legitimacy, as long as he doesn't go off on Xi Jinping or Li Keqiang or Party Central.
I mean, to me, this trial is the equivalent of Yang Rei's dialogue program. Like, as Yang Rei's dialogue is to, like, a proper talk show where you can actually ask some real questions, this trial was to, like, a proper court case, right? You're with me on this, Ed.
Right.
I understand what you're arguing.
There might be unintended consequences. Like, where I give it some leeway is I think there might be unintended consequences of the trial. Yeah,
sure.
I just don't think that they have the PR savvy to be able to think
that far. Oh, I disagree. Kaiser, you of all people, like, I thought you'd give the party more credit.
No, for everything but PR savvy, where they're but I think, consistently
see, here's what, Chinese, not too far. I'll give an example. Chinese people,
in some ways, I would compare it to the way that they tried to manage the Uyghur rights in 2009, where instead of doing what they did with Tibet in 2008, because I think they realized that by sealing off everything, then the message of the exiles was the dominant message in the Western media. They actually allowed all of us to fly to Urumqi, put us up in a hotel, gave us internet access, and said, you go out in the streets and report. And they hoped that then, it was a very sophisticated PR move, and their hope then was that what we would do is write these, like, sad stories about the Han, ethnic Han who were killed, and thus that would prove that there was rioting by the Uyghurs. And we all did that, but we also wrote stories that contextualized it and saying it's because of policies and the system control in Xinjiang that it gets to this level. I think they weren't happy with that, but the way that they managed us initially was a sophisticated peer move, and I would say that this trial is similar to that.
Okay, let's wrap there. That's very interesting, a good observation, and let's move to the part where we make recommendations. Just in the interest of time here, great discussion, guys. Thanks very much. I think our listeners are going to find that very enlightening. Why don't we start with you, Jeremy? What do you have?
All right, very quick one. Literally a Twitter feed. The Twitter feed of Jorge Guajardo, the almost departing Beijing
Mexican ambassador
of Mexico, who knew Bo Xilai and was tweeting some interesting details about Boisi Lai, and you can read his Twitter feed for some of those details.
Give us a little bit of juice. What did he have to say here?
Well, for example, Bo talked about in the trial how one of the allegations was about how somebody had recorded, what was it about? Somebody had recorded him on a cell phone.
Right.
He was talking on the cell phone about some corrupt deal that he was going to be involved in.
Right.
And Bo said that that's ridiculous. Anyone who knows him knows that he would never have cell phones present in a meeting like that, you know. And Jorge tweeted that, in fact, that was the case. He was the only senior Chinese leader that he'd met who insisted that there were no cell phones in the room when they had meetings.
Confirming that detail.
Yeah. So, you know, just stuff that's...
So Jorge Guajardo, what's the Twitter? At?
At Jorge underscore...
J-O-R-G-E.
G-U-A-J-A-R-D-O. He's Mexican.
I started following that Twitter feed during the trial also because of he was tweeting interesting things. And there was one thing that talks about the showmanship of Ball where Ball would come into the room after, unlike other officials he met, he wouldn't be greeted at the door by Ball, but Ball would wait until everyone's seated in the room and then make an entrance. So it seemed very imperial. And
everybody had to stand up.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So it's part of Ball's showmanship.
Very good. James, what do you have for us?
Well, we have to mention John Garnett's House of Bo.
Yes.
Available as an e-book. A wonderful piece of journalism exploring the web of contacts and political intrigues surrounding the Bo family. Another book that I would love to recommend, not related to China at all, is my own wife's latest novel. This is her fifth, and this one not related to China, unlike previous ones, called Carnaby, a young adult a book published by Simon & Schuster under the name of Kate Sampson, a new pseudonym.
Oh, great.
She's previously published under Catherine.
Catherine Sampson was her previous name.
So this is not a Kate. Kate.
C-A-T-E.
Yeah, C-A-T-E.
Yeah, it's a good young adult kind of nom de plume. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Very good.
She'll be it's the called Carnaby. Breadwinner.
Is it C-A-R-N-A-B-Y?
C-A-R-N-A-B-Y.
Yes. Okay, very good. Carnaby. Great. We'll check it out.
And then I guess on the Bo book recommendation list is also a book by Ho Pin and Huang Wenguang, which is published by an American publisher, and it sort of brings forward the tale of Bo a little bit because I think it was published after John's excellent book, John Garnell's excellent book, and also a shorter ebook by Jamil Anderlini. But this one,
that's a great one too,
was published just a few months ago, I believe, and it has I think Garnell's book focuses on the ideology and his rise in Chongqing, the policies there, and how that he built his name there. This one has many, many salacious details about sort of the interpersonal rivalries with other party members and things about it's got long profiles of the police chief Wang Lijun. It talks about sort of some Bo's allies like Zhou Yongkang. So it's got, I think it's, it tries to capture some of the tabloidy flavor of the scandal that's taking place. And I think everyone can agree there are many tabloid elements in the scandal.
Absolutely. One I can't remember whether it was John Garneau's or Jamil Anderlini's book that talks about his insistence on inviting Sylvester Stallone to that was Jamil's book,
right? Yeah,
that was hysterical. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've got something to wrap things up. My recommendation is Blocked on Weibo by Jason Q. Eng, and the website of the same name. This is an incredibly valuable resource for anybody who wants to peek into the mind of what the Chinese leadership finds particularly sensitive and why they do. It's great. Jeremy, you've got a copy of it too, right? It's an incredibly fun read, and it's great because, you know,
great toilet reading.
Exactly. It's one page,
each page is one word or one phrase and an explanation of why it's blocked. So
it's a book that you should read quickly because it's going to be out of date.
I mean it in the best possible sense of the word.
But it's been a lot of fun. I've got a copy of mine. It actually made it through the mail to my desk at Baidu, so I'm pretty happy.
Blocked on Weibo, but not blocked by China Post.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Good. Sorry, Jason, he'll have to try a little harder to have his book banned here.
a true badge of honor. Okay, well, thanks, Sage.
Do they ban books anymore? Maybe they don't ban books.
They
still
they ban books.
They ban books.
Sean Ryan's book is banned. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks,
James. We'll have you back again soon, I hope.
Thanks very much.
Great to have you.
Pleasure.
Anyway, folks, we will see you next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care. Bye.